From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The House of the Nightmare. I first caught sight of the house from the brow of the mountains as I cleared the woods and looked across the broad valley several hundred feet below me, to the low sun sinking towards the far blue hills. From that moment, the viewpoint I had was an exaggerated sense of looking almost vertically down. I seemed to be hanging over the checkerboard of roads and fields dotted with farm buildings, and felt the familiar deception that I could almost throw a stone upon the house. I barely glimpsed its slate roof. What caught my eye was the bit of road in front of it, between the mass of dark green trees about the house and the orchard opposite. Perfectly straight it was, bordered by an even row of trees, through which I made out a cinder side path and a low stone wall. Conspicuous on the orchard side between two of the flanking trees was a white object, which I took to be a tall stone, a vertical splinter of one of the tilted limestone reefs with which the fields of the region are scarred. The road itself I saw plain as a boxwood ruler on a green baize table. It gave me a pleasurable anticipation of a chance for a burst of speed. I had been painfully traversing closely forested, semi-mountainous hills. Not a farmhouse had I passed, only wretched cabins by the road, more than 20 miles of which I had found very bad and hindering. Now, when I was not many miles from my expected stopping place, I looked forward to better going and to that straight, level bit in particular. As I sped cautiously down the straight beginning of the long descent, the trees engulfed me again, and all I sight of the valley. I dipped into a hollow, rose on the crest of the next hill, and again saw the house, nearer and not so far below. The tall stone caught my eye with a shock of surprise. Had I not thought it was opposite the house next to the orchard? Clearly it was on the left-hand side of the road towards the house. My self-questioning lasted only the moment as I passed the crest. Then the outlook was cut off again, but I found myself gazing ahead, watching for the next chance at the same view. At the end of the second hill, I only saw the bit of road obliquely and could not be sure, but as at first the tall stone seemed on the right side of the road. At the top of the third and last hill, I looked down the stretch of road under the overarching trees, almost as one would look through a tube. There was a line of whiteness which I took for the tall stone. It was on the right. I dipped into the last hollow. As I mounted the farther slope, I kept my eye on the top of the road ahead of me. When my line of sight surmounted the rise, I marked the tall stone on my right hand among the serried maples. I leaned over, first on one side, then on the other, to inspect my tires. Then I threw the lever. As I flew forward, I looked ahead. There was the tall stone on the left side of the road. I was really scared and almost dazed. I meant to stop dead, take a good look at the stone, and make up my mind beyond my imagination whether it was on the right or the left, if not indeed in the middle of the road. In my bewilderment, I was speeding along, the machine leaping forward, everything I touched went wrong. I steered wildly, slew to the left, and crashed into a big maple. When I came to my senses, I was flat on my back in the dry ditch. The last rays of the sun sent shafts of golden green light through the maple boughs overhead. My first thought was an odd mixture of appreciation of the beauties of nature and disapproval of my own conduct in touring without a companion. Then my mind cleared and I sat up. I felt myself from the head down. I was not bleeding, no bones were broken, and while much shaken, I had suffered no serious bruises. Then I saw the boy. He was standing at the edge of the cinder path near the ditch. He was stocky and solidly built, barefoot, with his trousers rolled up to his knees. He wore a sort of butternut shirt opened at the throat and was coatless and hatless. He was tow-headed with a shock of tousled hair, was much freckled and had a hideous hair lip. He shifted from one foot to the other, twiddled his toes, and said nothing whatever, though he stared at me intently. I scrambled to my feet and proceeded to survey the wreck. It seemed distressingly complete. My car hadn't blown up, not even caught on fire, but otherwise the ruin appeared hopelessly thorough. Everything I examined seemed worse smashed than the rest. My two hampers, alone by one of those cynical jokes of chance, had escaped. Both had pitched clear of the wreckage and one hurt, not even a bottle broken. During my investigation, the boy's faded eyes followed me continuously, but he uttered no word. When I had convinced myself of my helplessness, I straightened up and addressed him. "How far is it to a blacksmith shop or a car repair shop?"
8 miles, he answered. He had a distressing case of cleft palate and was scarcely intelligible.
"Can you drive me there?" I inquired.
"Nary team on the place," he replied. "Nary horse, nary cow."
"How far to the next house?" it continued.
6 miles, he responded.
I glanced at the sky. The sun had already set. I looked at my watch. It was going 7:36. "May I sleep in your house tonight?" I asked.
"You can come in if you want to," he said, "and sleep if you can. House all messy. Ma's been dead 3 years and Dad's away. Nothing to eat but buckwheat flour and rusty bacon."
"I've plenty to eat," I answered, picking up a hamper. "Just take that hamper, will you?"
"You can come in if you've a mind to," he said, "but you got to carry your own stuff."
He did not speak gruffly or rudely, but appeared mildly stating in an offensive fact.
"All right," I said, picking up the other hamper. "Lead the way."
The yard in front of the house was dark under a dozen or more immense Atlantis trees. Below them, many small trees had grown up, and beneath these a dank underwood of tall, rank suckers out of the deep, shaggy, matted grass. What had once been apparently a carriage drive, or more recently, a place to drive in your automobile, left a narrow, curved track, disused and grass-grown, leading to the house. Even here were some shoots of the ailanthus, and the house was unpleasant, with the vile smell of the roots and suckers, and the insistent odor of their flowers. The house was of gray stone, with green shutters faded almost as gray as that stone. Along its front was a veranda, not much raised from the ground, and with no balustrade or railing. On it were several hickory splint rockers. There were 8 shuttered windows towards the porch, and midway of them a wide door, with small violet panes on either side of it and a fanlight above.
"Open the door," I said to the boy.
"Open it yourself," he replied, not unpleasantly nor disagreeably, but in such a tone that one could not help but take the suggestion as a matter of course. I put down the 2 hampers and tried the door. It was latched but not locked, and opened with a rusty grind of its hinges, on which it sat crazily, scraping the floor as it turned. The passage smelt moldy and damp. There were several doors on either side. The boy pointed to the first on the right.
"You can have that room," he said. I opened the door. What with the dusk, the interlacing trees outside, the piazza roof and the closed shutters, I could make out little.
"Better get a lamp," I said to the boy.
"Nary lamp," he declared cheerfully. "Nary candle. Mostly I get a bed before dark."
I returned to the remains of my conveyance.
All four of my lamps were merely scrap metal and splintered glass. My lantern was mashed flat. I always, however, carried a flashlight. This I found that split and crushed, but still holding together. I carried it to the porch and cautiously turned it on. Entering the room where I found the boy standing just where I had left him, I opened the flashlight to a stronger power. And then I looked around me. The walls were whitewashed, the floors bare. There was a mildewed, chilly smell, but the bed looked freshly made up and clean, although it felt clammy. With a few drops of its own grease, I felt something dripping from a fireplace in the corner. I turned my flashlight in that direction, and in the other corner saw a rickety little bureau. There was nothing else in the room save two rush-bottom chairs and a small table. I went out on the porch, brought in my suitcase, and put it on the bed. I raised the sash of each window and pushed open the shutter. Then I asked the boy, who had not moved or spoken, to show me the way to the kitchen. He led me straight through the hall to the back of the house. The kitchen was large and had no furniture save some pine chairs, a pine bench, and a pine table. I found two candles on the opposite corners of the table. I lit them, then I looked around me. There was no stove or range in the kitchen, only a big hearth, the ashes in which smelt and looked a month old. The wood in the woodshed was dry enough, but even it had a celery stale smell. The axe and hatchet were both rusty and dull, but usable, and I quickly made a big fire. To my amazement, for the mid-June's evening was hot and still. The boy, a wry smile on his ugly face, almost leaned over the flames, hands and arms spread out, and fairly roasted himself. "Are you cold?" I inquired. "I'm always cold," he replied, hugging the fire closer than ever, so I thought he must scorch. I left him toasting himself while I went in search of water. I discovered the pump, which was in working order and not dry on the valves, but I had a furious struggle to fill the two leaky pails I had found. When I put water to boil, I fetched my hampers from the porch. I brushed the table and set up my meal. Cold chicken, cold ham, white and brown bread, olives, jam, and cake. When the can of soup was hot and the coffee made, I drew up two chairs to the table and invited the boy to join me. "I ain't hungry," he said. "I've had supper." He was a new sort of boy to me. All the boys I knew were hearty eaters and always ready. I had felt hungry myself, but somehow, when I came to eat, I had little appetite and hardly relished the food. I soon made an end of my meal, covered the fire, blew out the candles, and returned to the porch, where I dropped into one of the hickory rockers to smoke. The boy followed me silently and seated himself on the porch floor, leaning against a pillar, his feet on the grass outside. "What do you do," I asked, "when your father is away?" "Just loaf around," he said, "just fool around." "How far off are your nearest neighbors?" I asked. "Don't know neighbors, never come here," he stated. "Say they're afeard of the ghosts." I was not at all startled. The place had all those aspects which lead to a house being called haunted. I was struck by his odd matter-of-fact way of speaking. It was as if he had said they were afraid of a cross dog. "Do you ever see any ghosts around here?" I continued. "Never see him," he answered, as if I mentioned tramps or partridges. "Never hear him, sort of feel him round sometimes." "Are you afraid of them?" I asked. "Nope," he declared. "I ain't scared no ghosts. I'm scared of nightmares." "Ever have nightmares?" "Very seldom," I replied. "I do," he returned. "I always have the same nightmare. Big sow, big as a steer, trying to eat me up. Wake up so scared I could never run. Never. Nowheres to run to. Go to sleep and have it again. Wake up more scared than ever. Dad says it's buckwheat cakes in summer." "You must have teased a sow sometime," I said.
"Yep," he answered. "Teased a big sow once, holding up one of her pigs by the hind legs. Teased her too long. Fell in the pen and got bit up some. Wish I hadn't teased her. Have that nightmare 3 times a week sometimes. Worse than being burnt out. Worse than ghosts. Say, I sort of feel ghost around now."
He was not trying to frighten me. He was as simply stating his opinion as if he had spoken of bats and mosquitoes. I made no reply and found myself listening involuntarily. My cigarette went out. I really didn't want another, but I didn't want to go to bed yet. I was really comfortable where I was at. The smell of the blossoms. I went ahead then and lit another cigarette. As I puffed, somehow I dozed off for a moment. I awoke with a sensation of some light fabric trailed across my face. The boy's position was unchanged.
"Did you do that?" I asked sharply. "Ain't done anything," he rejoined. "What was it?"
"It was like a piece of mosquito netting brushed over my face."
"That ain't netting," he asserted.
"That's a veil."
"That's one of the ghosts."
"Some blow on you. Some touch you with their long, cold fingers.
That one with the veil she drags across her face, well, mostly I think it's Ma."
He spoke with the unassailable conviction of the child in "We Are Seven." I found no words to reply and rose to go to bed.
"Good night," I said.
"Good night," he echoed. "I'll sit out here a spell yet." I lit a match, found the candle had stuck in the corner of the kitchen, since my poor flashlight was falling apart. I got undressed. The bed had a comfortable husk mattress, and I was soon asleep. I had the sensation of having slept some time when I had a nightmare, the very nightmare the boy had described. A huge sow, big as a dray horse, was rearing up with her forelegs over the footboard of the bed, trying to scramble over to me. She grunted and puffed, and I felt I was the food she craved. I knew in the dream that it was only a dream, and strove to wake up. Then the gigantic dream beast floundered over the footboard, fell across my shins, and I awoke. I was in darkness as absolute as if I were sealed in a jet vault. Yet the shudder of the nightmare instantly subsided, my nerves quieted. I realized where I was and felt not the least panic. I turned over and was asleep again almost at once. Then I had a real nightmare, not recognizable as a dream, but appallingly real, in unutterable agony of reasonless horror. There was a thing in the room, not a sow, nor any other nameable creature, but a thing. It was as big as an elephant, filled the room to the ceiling, was shaped like a wild boar seated on its haunches, with its forelegs braced stiffly in front of it. It had a hot, slobbering red mouth full of big tusks, and its jaws worked hungrily. It shuffled and hunched itself forward inch by inch, till its vast forelegs straddled the bed. The bed crushed up like wet blotting paper, and I felt the weight of the thing on my feet, on my legs, on my body, on my chest. It was hungry, and I was what it was hungry for, and it meant to begin on my face. Its dripping mouth was nearer and nearer. Then the dream helplessness that made me unable to call or move suddenly gave way, and I yelled and woke. This time my terror was positive and not to be shaken off. It was nearly dawn. I could see dimly through the cracked, dirty window panes. I got up, lit the little stump of the candle, and found 2 fresh ones inside the little bureau drawer. I dressed quickly, put together my ruined suitcase, put it on the porch against the wall near the door. Then I called the boy. I realized quite suddenly I had not told him my name or asked his. I shouted, "Hello," a few times, but won no answer. I had had enough of that house. I was still permeated with a panic of the nightmare. I desisted from shouting, made no search, but with 2 candles went out to the kitchen, took a swallow of cold coffee, and munched a biscuit as I hustled my belongings into the hampers. Then, leaving a silver dollar on the table, I carried the hampers out on the porch and dumped them by my
suitcase. It was now light enough to see to walk, and I went out to the road. Already the night dew had rusted much of my auto, making it look more hopeless than ever. It was, however, entirely undisturbed. There was not so much as a wheel track or even a hoof print on the road. The tall white stone uncertainty about which had caused my disaster stood like a sentinel opposite where I had upset. I set to find out a repair shop. Before I had gone far, the sun rose clear from the horizon and was almost at once scorching. As I footed along, I grew very much heated, and it seemed more like 10 miles than 6 before I reached the first house. It was a new frame house, neatly painted and close to the road, with a whitewashed fence along its garden front. I was about to open the gate when a big black dog with a curly tail bounded out of the bushes. He did not bark, but stood inside the gate, wagging his tail and regarding me with a friendly eye. Yet I hesitated with my hand on the latch and considered. The dog might not be friendly as he looked, and the sight of him made me realize that except for the boy, I had seen no creature about the house where I had spent the night. No dog or cat. Not even a toad or bird. While I was ruminating upon this, a man came from behind the house. "Will your dog bite?" I asked. "Nah," he answered. "He don't bite. Come in." I told him that I'd had an accident to my automobile and asked if he could drive me to a repair shop and then back to the wreck. "Sir," he said, "happy to help you. I'll hitch up shortly. Where'd you smash?" "In front of the gray house, about 6 miles back," I answered. "That big stone-built house?" he queried. "The same," I said. "Did you go past here?" he inquired, astonished. "I didn't hear you." "No," I said. "I came from the other direction." "Why," he meditated, "you must have smushed up about sunup. Did you come over the mountains in the dark?" "No," I replied. "I came over them yesterday evening. I smashed up about sunset."
"Sundown?" he exclaimed. "Where in thunder have you been all night?"
"I slept in the house where I broke down."
"In that big stone-built house in the trees?" he demanded.
"Yes," I agreed.
"Why," he quavered excitedly, "that their home is haunted. They say you have to drive past it after dark. You can't tell which side of the road the big white stone is on."
"I couldn't tell even before sunset," I said.
"There," he exclaimed, "look at that now. And you slept in that house. Did you sleep honest?"
"I slept pretty well," I said, "except for a nightmare. I slept all night."
"Well," he commented, "I wouldn't go in that there house for a farm, nor sleep in it for my salvation."
"And you slept? How in thunder did you get in?"
"The boy took me in," I said.
"What sort of boy?" he queried, his eyes fixed on me with a queer, countrified look of absorbed interest.
"Thick-set, freckled-faced boy with a hair lip," I said.
"Talk like his mouth was full of mush?" he demanded.
"Yes," I said, "bad case of cleft palate."
"Well," he exclaimed, "I never did believe in ghosts, and I never did half believe that house was haunted, but I now know as sure as the truth."
"And you slept?"
"I didn't see any ghosts," I retorted irritably.
"You seen a ghost for sure," he rejoined solemnly. "That there hair-lip boy's been dead 6 months."
And now for our next story. Out of the rack I rise.
"Chuchin's Inn," said the assistant stage manager to the manager of the Blackton Empire.
"Oh, yes. How's he seem?" "Much the same, sour as ever. Well, even sourer."
"A superb conjurer," said the manager, "but between ourselves, a very nasty bit of work."
"You could be right," laughed the assistant stage manager.
"Watch his turn tonight," said the manager. "A pal of mine told me he was slipping." "I was going to, for another reason. Did you remember what this is?"
"How do you mean?"
"Anniversary of his wife's death."
"Good Lord, how time skipped.
He has married again, hasn't he?"
"Yes," said the assistant stage manager. "That assistant of his.
There was a certain amount of talk when his wife was drowned, wasn't there?"
"Yes, may have been unfair,
It always looks a shade odd when you take your wife out night bathing and she doesn't come back.
Potty was never recovered, was it? Asked the manager.
Well, no, but oddly enough, a trawler landed a skeleton believed to be a woman's this morning.
It had been caught in their nets.
It's in the mortuary around the corner now. There'll be an inquest in a day or two, but I understand it's quite unidentifiable.
He treated her pretty rough, didn't he?
She certainly looked as if he did. And then, of course, getting married again within a couple of months to a girl half your age and such a bold designing minx into the bargain.
Matter of fact, I didn't think she looked too happy just now.
I can understand that.
Is there feeling against him in the town, do you think? Will they give him the bird?
I don't think so. Anyway, I'll watch carefully and report to you.
Okay.
Chuchin's real name was Jerry Pullen. He had adopted the stage name because he had the Mongol fold to his eyes and a vaguely Oriental cast of countenance. With a Mandarin skull cap, a black bootlace mustache, and enveloped in a voluminous priest robe, he looked the part well enough. He was very tall and always paced the stage in majestic Mr. Wu attitudes. He used no pad at all, never opening his mouth from start to finish of his turn. He distracted attention by two means. He fixed his queer eyes on the audience, and the female members of it were often slightly hypnotized by his piercing stare. To lull male alertness, he relied on his assistant, a big, bold-eyed strapping wench. He dressed her in the briefest and tightest of shorts, a low-necked, almost transparent blouse, and a coolie hat. She made her move frequently behind him, as though arranging the things on his work tables, and the men gave her plenty of eye. She also did any talking that was necessary. Jerry was around 50 and cordially detested in the profession, being sly, grasping, and utterly unsociable. But he was recognized as a master of his craft, his manual dexterity being unrivaled and his overall technique superb. He topped the bill everywhere. The assistant stage manager took his stand in the prompt wing at the curtain rose, and Chu Chin and the girl came on the stage. His reception was damp and unenthusiastic, but there were no boos or other manifestations of hostility. The assistant stage manager was himself a competent amateur conjurer, also better known as a magician, and always watched Chu Chin when he got the chance to sharpen his skill. Just as a golfer or billiards player studies a pro, to absorb something of his balance, touch, and rhythm, the essence of his mastery. And on this occasion, he was particularly concerned to decide whether the manager's suggestion about Chu Chin's decline was true or not. He was, as ever, the last turn of the evening. He had two work tables, one on each side of the stage, some chairs for volunteers from the audience, and at the back was a high contraption, a three-sided screen with an orange silk curtain making the fourth side, and always behind him moved the big girl, smiling and showing off her points. His first trick was about the oldest on the list, just pulling things out of a top hat, and he made it fresh and amusing. He would place in the hat, say, a miniature baby's feeding bottle and extract a small bottle of whiskey, replace that and produce an imitation red rose. The assistant stage manager knew how it was done, but he never ceased to be marveled at the slick virtuosity of Chu Chin's execution. He usually ended by flashing out the flags of all the more respectable nations, but on this occasion he drew out a woman's black bathing cap. The assistant stage manager frowned and shrugged his shoulders. What an incredible and monstrous error of taste.
But what is that? Jerry stared at it for a moment and then flung it down like a hot coal.
Then he glared out at the audience as though demanding, "Which one of you had done this?" And somehow, at that moment, the assistant stage manager knew beyond all doubt that Jerry had drowned his wife. From the audience came a short-lived, puzzled murmur. The girl ran forward, picked up the cap, and put it on a work table. The assistant stage manager watched her do this. The brazen smile had left her face. And when she was standing still again, he saw she was trembling violently.
It then became her business to appeal to the audience for 4 volunteers to come to the stage and cooperate in the next trick. Her voice as she did so, the assistant manager noted, was not quite under control. After some hesitation, 4 persons responded. A girl, 2 young men, and a tall woman dressed in an unrelieved black and heavily veiled. She looked, thought the assistant stage manager, extremely out of place. Chu Chin took up a pack of cards and the assistant said, "Each of you please take 3 cards and memorize them." The woman in black took 3 cards and at once held them up for Chu Chin to see. The assistant manager could see them too. They were the 8 of spades, the ace, and the 9 of spades in that order. Now the assistant stage manager, like all magicians, did a little light-hearted fortune-telling for the amusement of his friends. So he knew that it was the most sinister combination of all, spelling a sudden death, and very soon. Then the woman in black let them fall from her hand and left the stage and apparently the theater also. In his subsequent investigations, the assistant stage manager had reason to doubt whether she had been in the house at all until the girl called for volunteers. The doorman denied having seen her come in and still more oddly ever seeing her go out. Her appearance and disappearance remained a complete mystery, which was never solved. Jerry took his contrants fairly well and went on with his trick, but the assistant stage manager could see the audience was getting restive. They vaguely sensed something was going wrong, and there was much shuffling and some murmuring. The assistant stage manager himself was perplexed in the extreme. Was there a conspiracy on? Had certain persons determined to wreck the turn? If so, it had been most subtly organized, for how had they been able to tamper with Chu Chin's props? He knew the discomforting sense that there was something afoot of which he could not grasp the significance, as though there was being enacted some play within a play, as it were. Chu Chin finished the card stunt, a very clever and difficult one, satisfactorily, and then there was some applause from the audience, which had become quiet. The assistant stage manager, who understood audiences like the back of his hand and could register their reactions with delicate certainty, realized it was still on edge and embarrassed. About 20 persons even left the house. But if all went well from now on, it would settle down. Any further irritant or upset, however, might send it right out of control. He'd seen that happen once, and it was a daunting memory. Chu Chin's next offering was his famous poster illusion, which he kept a tight secret. The assistant stage manager had no notion how it was done. The conjurer took a large sheet of paper about the size of a newspaper bill on which was inscribed in the boldest scarlet lettering the legend, "Today's date is." Then in full view of the audience, he screwed up the paper into a tight ball, then unscrewed it again, smoothed it out, and what should have appeared was August 21st of the current year. The current date. Instead, the 7 and 6 of it read August 21st, 2016, the date of his wife's death. At once there was a loud murmur, a loud and angry murmur from the audience, and the applause was stillborn. "Who is doing these things?" thought the assistant stage manager. "And how is he doing them?" And now for the first time he felt fear. Chu Chin had unrolled the paper without glancing at it, but now he hurriedly inspected it. Once more his face was convulsed with rage, and he screwed it up again and hurled it into a wing. Realizing his act was on the verge of disaster, he omitted some further business and hurried on with other preparations for his final illusion. For this he employed the screen contraption. First of all, the girl called for a volunteer, and after some delay an elderly man came up. She asked him to pick out any spot near the middle of the stage on which he would like the contraption to be placed, first assuring himself there was no trap door by scrutiny and stamping. He did so, and the contraption was erected over the indicated spot. As the elderly man turned to leave the stage, he slipped and fell heavily, and was in obvious pain as Chu Chin assisted him to his feet. "Why don't you keep that stage dry?" he angrily exclaimed. "Look at that damp patch!" Refusing to be mollified, he hobbled from the theater. The audience began whistling and shouting, and a number began hurrying out. The assistant stage manager later asked one of them why he had done so, and he replied, "It was simply that I had a feeling something horrible was about to happen, something I had no wish to witness." There was consequently much stir and some confusion as Chu Chin went on with his trick, and the girl, in a vibrating falsetto, asked for silence. The illusion consisted, the assistant stage manager knew, in the girl entering the tent. Then Chu Chin would lower the silk curtain, raise it again, and reveal the tent empty. He would then enter the tent himself and lower the curtain, and a little later they would both come into the stage from different sides. It was a brilliant mirror invention, entirely undetectable by the audience. Now came the moment for the girl to enter the tent, but this, it appeared, she refused to do. The audience became very quiet and watchful. The assistant stage manager was utterly baffled and more than ever conscious of a strangeness, unreality, and growing apprehension. After a moment, Chu Chin, his face a mask of fury, thrust the girl hard through the curtain. Just at that moment, the assistant stage manager saw something white. Could it be a fleshless arm? Flung up above the screen and down again. There came a high, thin scream of agony and terror, and the tent was violently shaken. The assistant stage manager turned and shouted an order for the curtain to be lowered. Instead, every light in the house went out. Now the audience started shouting and screaming and surging toward the exits. For a moment, the assistant stage manager felt inexorably compelled to watch the stage. He heard the tent crash over, and then he could just discern in that dimness of glows three. He could swear it was three figures struggling violently near where it had stood. Still in wild motion, they staggered down towards the footlights, and then the iron safety curtain roared down like a blade of a huge guillotine, and all the lights came on again. Another shriek of terror came from the crowds milling around the jammed doors. "Play some music," yelled the assistant stage manager to the dazed conductor of the orchestra. He could see the runnels of red seeping through the curtain right below and dashed around into the stage. The bodies of Jerry and the girl were lying in their blood. The heavy safety curtain had crushed their skulls and then hurled them aside. After stagehands had carried them to the dressing rooms, the ambulances were summoned. The assistant stage manager returned to the stage. In the middle of it lay the 8, ace, and 9 of spades in that order. By the side of one of the work tables lay the black bathing cap. He picked it up. It was damp to the touch.